I'm thirsty. Just think how many times you hear that when you're at the sports field with your kids or out on a hot summer hike or just driving around in the car. Water is obviously a go-to, but have you ever thought about healthy hydration? Element is a zero-sugar electrolyte drink mix born from the growing body of research revealing that optimal health outcomes occur at sodium levels 2 to 3 times government recommendations. Electrolyte deficiency or imbalance can cause headaches, cramps, fatigue, brain fog, and weakness. Element helps anyone stay hydrated as each stick pack delivers a meaningful dose of electrolytes free of sugar, artificial colors, or other dodgy ingredients found in popular electrolyte and sports drinks. That's why Element is trusted and used by everyone from the Olympic weightlifting team, NFL and NBA players, Stanford neuroscientists, and everyday moms like me. Our kids actually fight over them. We keep the stick packs with us when we are on the go. They're super convenient. Head directly to our exclusive page at drinklmnt.com/1000hours to receive a free Element sample pack with any order. That's drinklmnt.com/1000hours to get your free sample pack with your order. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
All right, here we go. Welcome to the 1000 Hours Outside podcast. My name is Ginny Erich. I'm the founder of 1000 Hours Outside, and I'm so excited. I actually never even thought I would ask. I thought I would be too nervous to ask. I made my husband do it. Austin Kleon is here with us today. Welcome.
If a husband's good for anything, it's that, you know, so I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
So here's the story, Austin. I was at a leadership conference several years back, and there was this man there named Daniel Heffington. He's a singer-songwriter. And he was manning a booth for the company that he worked at. And they were giving out a copy of your book, Steal Like an Artist.
Oh, wow.
And I thought it was such a cool thing because usually when you're at a conference and you're manning a booth, you're just self-promoting. That's all you're doing,
yeah,
right? Promoting your own thing. And he was giving out your book. And he had said he'd had to go to the higher-ups because it was so impactful for him. And he wanted to give something that was truly impactful. So I came home with this incredible book. I mean, it's just a cool book. Beyond being like filled with so much. This book, Steal Like an Artist, which came out in 2012. And I love, I mean, this is a bit ago. I mean, it's over a decade ago.
Yeah.
When your work just is out there and it circles. And so I read this one, loved it so much. I got the other two, Show Your Work and Keep Going, all which are just, I mean, I always tell people, especially if you've got like even teens, preteens in your life, I mean, this is like the trifecta of gifts. I mean, absolutely incredible. So Austin, okay, first of all, thank you for being here.
Thank you. And thank you for being so nice about the books. They have kind of had a life of their own, which has been surprising to me and delightful. So I'm just pleased that people still read them.
Oh, they're fantastic. They are so inspiring. So you have written these books and you also have a newsletter with almost 200,000 subscribers over at austinkleon.com. People want to check that out. You have been on all sorts of publications, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. They've called your work brilliant. You speak at Pixar, Google, South by Southwest, TEDx, The Economist. You've been a librarian, a web designer, advertising copywriter, and so this deep life. But what you notice first, you read this book, and actually I told you right before we started, I was planning on talking about all three books because these books actually, like, they seem like they're small, right? So I was like, oh, you know, I'll probably be able to like talk about all three. And then I went to take notes and I had so many notes just on this one. I was like, there's no way we're going to be able to talk about all three books in one episode. But you notice immediately, like, this guy must have read so many books.
Yeah, I mean, like, the books are deceptive, you know, because they're little, but they're very compressed. There's like a lot, you know, I'm kind of there are a lot of books that are like one idea that goes on for 300 pages. I like to try to fit like 300 pages into, or 300 ideas into like 150 pages. That's like my idea of, you know, so they're like very compressed and dense. And that's why it takes me so long to do them. Sure. But yeah, I mean, like, reading is, I would say that reading is probably the heart of everything that I do and has been for the past, you know, I mean, most of my life, really. I mean, I grew up a big reader. You know, books have been kind of the through line in my life. And I have this really nice life now where I'm kind of a professional book reader in a sense. I mean, people are always like, oh, you became a professional to write books. And I said, no, I became a professional writer so I could read books for a living. Cause, you know, so much, that is where so many of the books come from. And I think if there's a magic to you alluded to the fact that people are still reading Steal Like an Artist after 12 years. And I think if there's a magic to that book, it's that it actually was made by the method that it espouses for other people. Like, it was made with the Steal Like an Artist method, and the idea that there's actually not that much that's original in the book. It all comes from someplace else. What's original, of course, is the way that it's all put together and the way it says what it has to say. That book, it will always be kind of impossible for me to recapture the magic of that book because it was made the way that the book is trying to get other people to work, you know?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you notice immediately, like, this guy must have read hundreds and hundreds of books, and the way that you weave them together is so brilliant. It's seamless. So this is actually one of the things that you talk about doing, which I thought was such a cool idea. And if people are interested, you end the book with recommended reading list, which I thought was so awesome. We have books like Flow, Amamat, which I actually have. Yeah. I haven't read it. It's sitting right by me.
Oh, she's great. Yeah. Yeah.
Rework. And then there were some I didn't know. And it was with this like little, like you'd written on a chalkboard. I will not, like when kids get in trouble at school, you know, like, I won't talk anymore to my neighbor or whatever.
Right.
It was like, I will not finish books I don't like. I will not finish books I don't like. Which, is that true?
I believe like deeply that reading is primarily for pleasure. Even if you're reading for, I think even if you're reading for material, like you're reading to learn something, there are so many books on the same topic everywhere that you really need to find a book that gives you pleasure when you're reading it. Like, I think it's really important for books to meet us where we are in the sense of we need to be kind of brought into the text. In a way, like, and there are some authors that are you're just not going to jive with. And one of my big pieces of advice to people who want to have a richer reading life, if they want to finish more books, I say, well, you need to quit more books. You need to be more promiscuous with your reading. I use the term like almost like speed dating. Like, it's kind of like you need to get used to like giving a book a shot, but then being able to put it down and go to another book if it's not doing something for you. And I think that's really, really important. It's the hardest tip that I have to, it's hard medicine. It's like my own medicine that it's hard for me to swallow a lot of the time because, but I do find that the more I quit books, the more books I end up finishing because every moment you spend with a book that's not really doing it for you is a moment that you could be spending with a book that is setting you on fire. And that's kind of how I, you know, it's an interesting, hard thing, but it's nothing you ever figure out in your reading life. You're always like working on that. It's still really hard for me. I get the reading life is kind of a roller coaster, you know, because there's just so many books out there and so many of them aren't for you. That's something that I try to train people. I'm like, you need to repeat the sentence over and over. It wasn't for me. Like, because the idea is that there are books there for you and there are books that are not for you. And you got to find the books that are for you. If you say a book that isn't for you, it could just not be for you right now. It might be for you in the future. It might be for the you in another time. And so that's like my number one tip for people who want to read more is like, you just got to quit more books and find the ones you really want to finish.
I've never heard anyone say that ever. And it is hard because you're scared. You're like, well, what if I miss?
What if I miss something?
Something later.
Yeah. Yeah. The FOMO of reading is very real. It's like, well, what if there's some gem in here? And the fact of the matter is if there's really a gem in the book, there's probably someone's already picked that gem and quoted it somewhere or put it in another book like mine or something like that. So, you know, it's just a tricky thing, but I truly believe that a book on a sentence to sentence level, I trust the turning of pages. Like that there needs to be a momentum. If you're turning pages, the book is good, you know? And that includes trash. Like, you know, I think like, you know, that includes the trash reading. I mean, I do my fair share of it, but I really trust the turning of the pages. I think that's if you're turning pages, like I watch my kids read all the time and they're turning the pages. You know, I trust that.
Mm-hmm. That was good. If people want to know more about what you read, then every year you recap on your website at austincleon.com. So that's a pretty good thing. For the past over 15 years, people can go back and look at that. And it's in this book as well. So one of the ideas, and this is what you're saying, This book has kind of been birthed from this idea, as well as other ideas. But you say, this to me is like the analog rabbit hole. Chew on one thinker, writer, artist, activist, role model you really love. Study everything there is to know about that thinker. Then find three people that thinker loved and find out everything about them. Repeat this as many times as you can. So can you give us an example in your life who's one thinker that really inspired you and then you went down the rabbit hole?
Well, a big one for me is this woman named Linda Barry. She was a cartoonist for, she was a cartoonist who published in alternative newspapers for about 30, 35 years, I think. And then, she's had a kind of second act in her life as a teacher. And she wrote these marvelous books called, one of them's called What It Is. And that's the one that was a big influence on Steal Like an Artist. And then she's written these other really wonderful books. They're better for kids, actually, Making Comics. And there's a book called Syllabus, which is her syllabi from the class that she teaches. And they're these really marvelous, like kind of multi-textured collages of books. They're what I wish my books could be. You know, I'm still trying to get to her level of, I'll never reach it. You know, it's important to have people in our lives that we look up to that we like, we'll never, you know, get to. But Linda, I think I started reading her, and then it's just like one of those things where I just like tried to get my hands on everything that she read. So she's really inspired by, like anyone else, she's really inspired by lots of different people. So like, I got really into the psychologist D.W. Winnicott through her. Winnicott, you know, your listeners might know the idea of the good enough mother. That's where that idea comes from. And Winnicott wrote a book called Playing in Reality that's really wonderful, very dense, but very interesting. And like, you know, I mean, Linda loves, I mean, she loves all kinds of stuff. She loves R. Crumb and all these, she loves Family Circus. And like all these like cartoonists that I wouldn't kind of give the time of day to, but like she's able to write about them in a way that makes me see them in different ways. So like that's a person, someone like Kurt Vonnegut when I was younger. I mean, I wanted to read everything. I wanted to find out, you know, like, okay, Mark Twain and like anyone he met read. But I will say that when I was younger, the people who did this for me were actually musicians because I was such a music guy when I was young. I mean, I still am. But when I was younger, music was the thing that really brought me to a lot of like my interests. And so I would read interviews with the bands I really loved, and I would want to know what kind of music they listened to. So like a really important band for me, I'm like a 40-year-old dad, so like Radiohead is like a big, you know, big band for me. So like when I was younger, they were really good about having a website, and they always shared stuff that they loved. So that's how I got into Miles Davis. That's how I got into the Beatles' White Album. You know, that's how I got into Aphex Twin and like all these bands. So like that to me was the that was kind of when I learned this method. And then when I became a writer, it was like, okay, you love this person. This person's style came from somewhere. If you saturate yourself, if you find the influences that influence this person that's influencing you, basically what you do is you build your own kind of creative family tree, and then you can kind of pick the fruits from that tree and like you can grow your own branch, basically. But it's really a method of self-study, because I think one of the hard things if you're an autodidact, a kind of self-taught person like I am, you're constantly looking for lesson plans. You know, I mean, you're kind of looking because, you know, we still have that like school mind. It's like, oh, I have to have like a curriculum and I have to like whatever. But like that's just like a really easy way, I think, to really get the history of your medium in a way that is personally meaningful, because it's kind of this, if you try to just like digest the history of music all at once, it just doesn't seem doable, or like the history of writing at once. But if you start with something that you love as an entry point, and then you kind of make your way backwards and forwards, if you kind of like move your way through music that way, soon enough you find that everything's connected, but it's connected for you in a way that's meaningful. And I think that's really the thing that when you're teaching yourself, when you're learning as a like kind of self-guided learner, you need to start with whatever's making the gut strings vibrate for you. And then you kind of build the world out from there. And what happens is that everything's meaningful then because you're the one that's like made that path. And, you know, that's just like something that's been really rich in my life. And having that almost like scholarly approach to stuff that I love is just the way that I learn. And I think a lot of people, they kind of know what they like, but they don't know why they like it or where it comes from. Mm. The quicker you can teach yourself to learn where the things you like come from, the more, you know, just the richer your life becomes, I think.
This is fascinating. This is one of the most fascinating conversations I've ever had. Well, I wouldn't consider myself to be fairly creative. I've actually always been really afraid of the originality piece because I think I love to play the piano. I just read what the notes are on the paper because I think, well, how many people have already come? And I mean, surely I'm sure there's infinite combinations on a piano, but are there really?
Sure.
And so, like, I mean, if you look at your backdrop compared to my backdrop, I mean, I think it says it all, right? You've got a typewriter and vinyls and some sort of a card catalog thing and like signs and glue and doodots. And I mean, guitar, an electric guitar, books, this whole thing, things that you've drawn. For a person who's not super creative or feels that, like I kind of feel that.
Yeah.
And creativity often seems kind of like this out there thing, like you have it or you don't.
Sure.
But what you do is you give all these practical things.
Yeah.
And they're very practical. It's like, well, this family, you know, this tree idea. And then you say, then build your own tree. So read of these different people's things and don't read the books that you're not turning the pages and have an analog desk. It was very interesting to me that you could take something that for a lot of people feels maybe unattainable and give these practical ideas of things that they can do. I was curious about this Linda Barry, because you said in here somewhere that she was your favorite cartoonist. And I always think that statements like that are really a big deal. Obviously, you're a huge reader and you've studied so many things. To pick a favorite out of all the people that have come before, what makes her your favorite?
Well, I think so. One thing that I would say about everything that you said is a lot of my ethos, everything that comes through in my books, is the result of who I am as a person. And if you know where I came from and what I've spent my life trying to do, it makes sense. I grew up in the middle of a cornfield in Ohio to really smart, loving parents, but they were not artists. They were not writers. They were not musicians, even. What they were they were creative in really wonderful ways. I mean, my mother was, my mom was actually a home economics teacher for a while, and then she became a high school principal. But she taught people how to sew and how to cook. And so I was witnessing this marvelous, I was constantly watching her make things with her hands and to sew dresses and cook great food and like make the house nice. And she was constantly dragging me around to these awful craft fairs, which in hindsight, you know, were wonderful. And my dad is a, my dad was an extension agent. So he like ran the county fair basically. And so it was a very like rural childhood, but my dad was like, you know, both my parents have master's degrees. They're more educated than I am, really, on paper. And then, you know, but my dad would I remember building a barn with my dad, you know, like we, you know, like he's very good at like, just kind of like making stuff, like picturing things and then making them happen, talking to the people he needed to know to like make things happen. So like my parents actually are like intensely creative people. It's nothing that anyone would look at and say, oh, you're such a creative person. You know what I mean? So I grew up with that kind of like the real important creativity, which is creating a life. You know, people who create a life with their own hands, they don't, they aren't handed a life. They actually like make a life. And so I think for me, like that's, I got that very early on. Now, did I honor that early on? No, of course not. Like when I was a kid, I wanted to know, well, what's a real artist like? What is an artist do? Like a writer? How can I be a writer? Well, a musician, how do you do that? I don't know any of these people. Like, how do I get there? And so like, I would say at least most of my life has been spent figuring out how do you do this stuff? And I never went to art school. I mean, I went to college, but I never went to art school. I had a few really good professors and teachers and stuff, but like, you know, a lot of these books are just me trying to figure out this stuff for myself. And then what is really important to me is to communicate this kind of stuff in a language that is really accessible, is the language that I grew up with, the kind of plain spoken Midwestern forward, not too fussy kind of language, you know? So that's where it all comes from. And I think Linda appealed to me so much because Linda was the, I met Linda when I was like 22, 23. She was the first person I met who came from, like, she lives in the Midwest. She's like a very, like, she's just this, well, first of all, anyone who's met her, she just kind of has this magic to her. But she was the first person that was able to say, I was able to say, there's someone who does the things that I love together. It's like in this package. Here's like a person who's a real person with real personality and is a delight. And she's able to put pictures and words together in this magical way. Like, that's what I want to do. And so I think that's why she had such a big impact on me, because she was the first person I actually met in real life who was able to like meld that pictures and words. Because I grew up as somebody who really wanted to write and really wanted to make pictures. And I was like, I don't know how you like, I don't really want to be a cartoonist necessarily, although I did do that for a while. How do I like put all these things together that I'm trying to do? And she was just like one of those people for me. But like, I mean, she's also someone who, if my whole career is just pulling people upstream to her, like that's fine with me. You know, I'm happy to be her disciple, and whether she wants me to be or not.
Interesting. So it wasn't as much about the cartoons themselves as it was about her. It was about the cartoonist.
No, it's weird. I mean, I actually wasn't aware of Linda's work until I met her. This really great novelist named Dan Shaun. I had gone, my wife's from Cleveland, and we lived there for a while. And I had gone to one of his readings and drawn him. This was back in the early aughts when, you know, if you drew somebody and put it on the internet, they were going to see it because, you know, whatever. And Dan said, he emailed me and he said, oh, you made me look like a Linda Barry character. And I think we were out to coffee or something. He said, oh, you made me look like a Linda Barry character. I said, who's Linda Barry? And he just kind of like, who's Linda Barry? And he said, well, she's coming to Oberlin. We're having her to Oberlin. You should come meet her. You should come see her read. And that's like what introduced me to her. So I actually, you're right. I did get to know her before I knew her work. Of course, once I got into her work, I collected everything I could. And this was kind of before she had Linda's, like, her books were kind of out of print at that point, and like the alternative weeklies were kind of dying. And so she was really going into her second phase at that point. And so I would go to Half Price Books and just, you know, get everything of hers that I could possibly get. So yeah, you're right. It was the cartoonist, not the cartoons at first. But the weird thing is, like, I'm not actually anyone who's met her. It's just, I'm not very special. Like, everyone has this. She's just kind of a magical person. She's one of the few magical people I've actually met in life. So anyway.
Wow, that's so interesting. I think, but like the practicalities here of, this the reading and this, I mean, everybody talks about the rabbit hole, but they talk about it only in terms of the internet
Oh, right.
and really almost negatively, almost negatively.
Yeah.
Like you get sucked in, you get kind of
Right.
lost. And this is like this personhood deep dive. And I think anybody could do that. Any child could do that,
Yeah.
as long as your child is, maybe starting to read or things like that. Whatever it is they're interested in, it's who influences you and who influenced them.
Yeah.
And it just becomes this whole thing that gives you this big picture.
This podcast is sponsored by Active Skin Repair, a 1% for the planet member who believes personal health and health of the environment are connected. If you spend as much time outside as we do, which we hope you do, or really any time outside at all for that matter, you're bound to have kids that get nicked, scraped, or banged up, or perhaps come in from outside with an unexplained rash, or maybe you end up on the wrong side of a fall or a bad scrape yourself. That's why we love Active Skin Repair. Active Skin Repair is an all-natural and non-toxic topical solution that is formulated to help repair and heal damaged skin. It can be used to treat a wide range of skin issues, including cuts, scrapes, but also burns, sunburns, rashes, and other types of skin damage. It works by mimicking the natural immune response to help soothe irritation, reduce inflammation, and support healing. It's also safe and non-toxic, making it suitable for use on all skin types, including sensitive skin. It's really easy to add to your first aid kit. As if all of that wasn't amazing enough, Active Skin Repair donates 1% of all sales to grassroots environmental initiatives to protect and restore our national world, which is super cool. Visit
activeskinrepair.com to learn more about Active Skin Repair and their commitment to 1% for the planet. You can use code 1000hours to save 20% on all Active Skin Repair products. That's activeskinrepair.com. It's no secret. We love music in our household. And music lessons don't need to be expensive, boring, or stressful. Vogtberg Music Academy offers online lessons that siblings can share in the comfort of your own home. Instead of dragging kids to lessons and paying hundreds of dollars a month for one student, use my code OUTSIDE to get 50% off the first month when your children learns piano, fiddle, guitar, mandolin, or ukulele at VogtbergMusicAcademy.com. For only $15, get weekly lessons and practice principles, 24/7 access to your instructor, live student onboarding calls, and video vaults that provide dozens of extra lessons for students who want to progress faster. With Vogtberg Music Academy, you will never have to nag your children to practice as they work toward earning badges on their success path and performing for community student showcases. Once again, use my code OUTSIDE to give it a try. You get 50% off this month and give your children a lifelong love of music at VogtbergMusicAcademy.com. That's spelled VoetBerg MusicAcademy.com. And use code OUTSIDE when you sign up. And another really practical idea, which is the one that really stopped me in my tracks, I thought, especially as a parent, was this idea, and it wouldn't be practical in every home, but you could adjust it, was to have an analog workspace, an analog desk.
Yeah.
Tell us what that is and why you do it.
Well, you know, at first it was kind of a gimmick. I think, so just to, this is a really dumb, simple idea, but the idea for your listeners is everybody has a desk with a computer on it. Like everybody's desk at work looks the same, whether you're a creative person or a accountant or whatever. Yeah, you got a big, you know, keyboard and a mouse, whatever. But my idea that I got from reading about the cartoonist Art Spiegelman, Art Spiegelman has all these stations in his studio and they're all for different things. So he has like a drafting station, he has a scanning station, he has like all this different stuff. But the thing I took from him is like, oh, you should have desks for different things, like different modes you want to be in. Like, you should have a whole different space for it. So I came up with this idea for the analog desk. And the analog desk is actually off screen. It's right over here.
I think I can see, like, the corner of it.
Yeah, you can see just the corner of it. But, like, nothing electronics allowed on this desk. So this desk is just full of stuff you get at, like, Michael's or the, you know, school supply section at the grocery store. You know, it's just analog tools. And the thing that's interesting about having an analog space is when you go to it and you sit there, there's nothing to do unless you do it.
Right.
Right. And so it's just a way to trick your brain into coming up with ideas and to do stuff. And we did when the kids were little, and even now, it doesn't have to be fancy. I mean, when they were little, we had a tiny little table that just always had drawing paper and crayons and markers and stuff. And it was like a little kid analog desk, but you could do this anywhere. And I just find that if you have a space in your house where nothing electronic or bleepy or bloopy is allowed, it's a place that you can go to kind of like, you always get something when you sit down at the analog desk. It's really important for me in my own work, just because it's just so easy to be distracted and to be connected. And I think the big thing that I've learned as a creative person is like, there's this tension between connection and disconnection. It's like you need to be connected to the world in order to be inspired from it, but you need to disconnect from the world long enough to figure out what you're going to do with all that inspiration. And so that's the kind of that push and pull. The analog desk is a way of disconnecting from the world so you can connect with yourself.
I love the idea. I used it. It was so different. I'm like, writing things, you're using the computer, and then I was like, just pick up a Sharpie in a folder or whatever. Yeah. It's completely different. Like, I have a set of notes here, but then I also have, you know, the and it's just different. Yeah. I have a pad of paper, and because people are listening, they can't see what I hold up, right? It's like one of the huge sticky note pads, and I've got stars, and it's totally different. And you had this sentence in here. I was like, oh, this is good. You said, work that only comes from the head isn't any good. And I read it and I was kind of like, is that really true? That's what I thought. And then you followed it up with this. Watch a great musician play a show. Watch a great leader give a speech. You'll see what I mean. I was like, oh, that's right. You have to move. You're right. You need to move. We have to do something with our bodies, not just our heads, which really is a testament back to your parents, correct? I mean, that's what they were doing.
Yeah. I think I got a lot of that. And, you know, there was a little bit of a tension in my house of, you know, mom really believed in book smarts and dad was more like, you know, like you need to be out in the world, like doing stuff. To that point, there's a wonderful book called I like to make these things called Volvels. I'm trying to like make things that with my hands that help me think. I think the problem in the culture is that we think thinking goes on in our brains, and it's really the wholeness of us. Thinking happens with our whole body. And there's a wonderful book about this called The Extended Mind by this woman named Annie Murphy Paul. And I made what's called these spinners. This is called a Volvel. And I actually made one for myself because what Annie Murphy Paul says is that we have these kind of concentric circles of things that we think with. So we think with the body. So that's this inner circle. And she says we use gesture and sensations and movement in our body. And then there's an outer ring. This is, what does that say? Surroundings. So that would be nature, which is your, you know, your thing. Buildings and ideas. Those are kind of the things around us. Okay. And then this third ring is relationships. So we have relationships with experts. We have relationships with our peers. We have relationships with groups. So I just made one of these spinners because I just noticed that her things, they kind of like, she doesn't do this in the book, but I noticed that she had 3, 3, and 3. And I thought, oh, you can do one of these spinners with this. So one of the things when I was thinking about her book is I like to kind of move things around. For example, if you put these spinners around here, like, movement, nature, and peers, that's like a certain kind of thinking that happens. So that would be like me on my bicycle out with my buddies talking. Mm-hmm. So the combination, you can have thoughts with any of these things, but it's really when you bomb your senses and your body with like all these different situations that you get good ideas. But the basic idea that I've learned is like, you just don't, some people can think in here and just sit and think, but you unlock something much deeper and richer if you try to get like a whole body experience. So that's why now, you know, I try to walk as much as I can. I try to talk with other people as much as I can. You know, I try to use my hands and make things and create things that I can think with, like that Volvel I just showed you. A lot of my life now is trying to figure out how I can get thoughts out of here, but more importantly, how I can get thoughts in here from out here. But that's just a way of saying that we don't just think with our head. But that was something I learned from Linda very early on, because she said, in the digital age, don't forget to use your digits.
Yes, I loved that.
This sent me down this path of using your hands and how important it is to use your hands and really your whole body to do good thinking. If you look at the history of scientists, writers, artists, it's shocking how much people walk. Like, walking is kind of this magic thing for people to do. Like, one of the things I tell people and keep going is like, if you're not feeling creative, like, go for a walk. I would say my 3-mile walk with my wife that we do every morning is like fundamental to who we are. And we actually started doing it when we had the kids, because you could strap the kids in the stroller and like put on an audiobook. And you know, that was an hour that you had, and it was good for everybody. So I just really believe, I'm somebody who wasn't in my body a lot as a kid. I just like always felt like kind of disconnected from my body and just like never really found like a good, I didn't really believe I was capable of that kind of, you know, full bodiedness. And the older I get, the more I can. And it's like really opened me up in good ways. So,
I mean, I would say if you're a parent of a teen or tween, I mean, what a must read, because we're just on these screens so much.
Yeah.
And you write about how this book began its life on index cards. You even had a deleted scenes in the back, which is like the index cards that didn't make it in. And so it's just a reminder. And so this two desks idea, even if you just swapped out your materials. So if you're losing steam, or your child is losing steam because they've been doing schoolwork all day and they come home and have more.
Right.
It's about just making a swap for a little bit until you feel like you can go back to the other one. Nothing electronic is allowed on the analog desk. This is where most of my work is born. So just another incredibly practical idea for families and for people. I loved that one.
And one thing I'd want to add to that is just that it's really the dance between the two that my work comes out of. It's the dance between the analog work and then going to the digital desk, because so much of my work is about sharing and connecting. And the analog desk is kind of like when I access myself and what I have to offer. And then the digital desk is kind of when I put it into a format or something that can be shared with other people. Like, that's my whole life. So it's that dance between them. And then so much of my digital life is where I get a lot of inspiration too. So I always want to tell, I'm kind of known as an analog guy, but I do always want to tell people, you know, it's the tension between the two, and it's the dancing that like the dancing between them. But so I that's why I like having different spaces, because the principle that it runs off, everybody knows like what it's like to, I got to go in the house and get my keys, and you walk through the door and you forget what you were looking for. Right. Our brains do that. It's just meant to do that. So if you go over to the desk, it's funny how you just forget what's behind, you know, at the other desk, you know. So it's just that tricking your brain into playing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I was thinking, like, even if you don't have the space for another desk, if you had just one of those little caddies that had different materials in it, and you would just pick that up and plop that on the kitchen table or wherever you're doing your things.
Yeah, a caddy is a great idea, or a bag, like take it to the park, you know, or something. Yeah, those little art caddies are really fun.
Yeah, just pull that out. It's all your analog stuff.
Kitchen table. Everybody's got a kitchen table. The kitchen table is. I mean, I work at the kitchen table all the time. We have a very small bungalow in Austin, and we have a gigantic kitchen table that we used to have in our bigger house. And we just stuck that sucker in there because it was so important to me that we have a big table. I think you should have a kitchen table that you can do surgery on, like a country doctor could come in and, like, you know, because there's something about having like a big kitchen table, everyone's around, and like you can really work and spread out. And so a kitchen table can become an analog desk, like with one of those art caddies, like you said. So that's like a really, really easy thing.
Mm-hmm. You have really cool ideas in your book in the back. No, this is from your website. Right on your website, you have favorite gear.
Oh, yeah.
Which I love that. So over at austincleon.com, you know, even just the idea of having a date stamp, I was like, oh, that's brilliant. How fun. Kids love stamps.
Oh, yeah.
So you're doing your work, you throw your date stamp. There's aqua notes that you could have in your shower, which that is a thing. Like, sometimes I'll get out of the shower and I'll be like, nobody talked to me for 5 minutes.
Right.
I got this idea and I have to write it down.
Yeah.
Your favorite pencil sharpener, Crayola slick sticks. I never even heard of those.
Oh, those are great. Those make every kid's drawing look like a Basquiat. Like, they're really cool. They're really fun. They're very imprecise and chunky, and they're very fun. Even adults like them.
Okay, what a cool idea. My favorite pen is the Pilot Precision V5.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That was the only thing that we were at odds
That's my wife's favorite. She loves that. She likes those little fine lines. I'm more of a big, bold line guy, so. Yeah.
So that's on the website. People can find that.
Yeah, people like having things to buy. Like, people like having a shopping list.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
The funny thing about art supplies is they really don't cost that. When you think about how much other things cost, like, art supplies don't really cost that much. Mm-hmm. I'm always telling other parents, just buy paper in bulk. Just spend the money. Get as much paper as you can. Let them waste it. Because it recycles. And I think people are so stingy with good materials for their kids. And it's, what do you, like, think about how much you spend on, like, Netflix every month or whatever, you know.
Soccer.
Like, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very much like, yeah, I thought it's really important. I mean, there was definitely a time in my youngest is a real drawer and always has been. And I mean, there was the time where he would go through 40 sheets of paper a day. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just like cranking through, and we were like, great, keep going. You know, we'd sweep him up with a broom and put him in the recycle bin.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. The Dewey dot markers. There's a great list of ideas there. And like I said, some I hadn't even heard of, which is always funny when you have kids and you think you would know of all the different ideas that are out there.
Yeah, no, that you never know. It's always incomplete. There's always something to learn.
Right.
Hair thinning is complicated. The problem is, it's actually much bigger than your hair alone. Like your skin, hair is a reflection of your health, and internal factors can impact the way your hair looks, feels, and grows. Nutrafol's whole body approach multi-targets underlying root causes like stress, hormone fluctuations, and nutrient gaps for visibly thicker, stronger hair.
Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding. While many supplements rely solely on ingredient studies, Nutrafol clinically tests final formulations to ensure their efficacy. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after taking Nutrafol Women's Hair Growth Supplement for only 6 months. Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code OUTSIDE. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com is spelled Nutrafol.com. Promo code is OUTSIDE. That's Nutrafol.com. Promo code OUTSIDE. We love bread in our house. I mean, who doesn't? PB&Js, turkey sandwiches, even just morning toast with butter. It's all good in our home. We're always on the hunt for a healthy alternative. That's why our family loves Hero Bread. It is delicious. They make delicious bread and products free of consequences or compromise. They've made carby, empty calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious versions that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories, plus protein and fiber. We love the classic white bread and the seeded bread, which are both made with olive oil and have a wonderful, rich taste to them. I was so surprised how soft both types of bread were. They were just the right blend of chewiness and sturdiness for making sandwiches. This bread is a favorite in our house for sure. The tortillas were also delicious, and we loved making simple cheese quesadillas as a snack. We're talking zero net carbs, high in fiber, 0 grams of sugar. What more could you ask for? Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code OUTSIDE at checkout. That's code OUTSIDE at hero.co. Okay, this is the big human experience. You never feel ready. So you write it out. You say you're ready. And then you put this sentence. So you say you feel like a phony, like you're just winging it, that you really don't have any idea what you're doing. Guess what? None of us do. But why does it seem like some people do?
I think when you're a kid, you almost have the sense that, like, one of the funniest things I've ever heard anyone say is I know this photographer, and one time he like got up to speak to teenagers and he said, you know that feeling you get that adults don't really know what they're doing? Honor that, because it's true. I thought that was the greatest thing I ever heard. I mean, I think part of the thing is that we, one of my writing heroes, Kurt Vonnegut, whenever his kids complained about the state of the world to him, he would just say, you know, I just got here too. It's not like I think part of the problem with being a human being is that you just don't get enough time to really become a true expert at anything. I mean, like, you know, you just don't, there's just really not enough time. And so we're always, even with parenting, I mean, like, you're like, no one gets the same parents. Like, that's really interesting. Like, my youngest didn't get the same parents that my oldest did because we were different people by the time he got here, even though it was only like 2 or 3 years, right? Okay. So it's just this idea that everything's constantly shifting, everything's changing, but particularly when it comes to being creative, I think the thing that people don't understand is uncertainty is the very fuel that creative work runs on. You have to be a little bit uncertain about what's going to happen because that's the great leap. When I sit down to draw, I don't necessarily know how the drawing's going to turn out. My job is to go to the page and have an experience and see what happens and to be flexible and open. That's why it's so important to make the first mark when you're drawing. Because once you make the first mark, then you have something to respond to. The worst thing you could do is freeze up and just stare at the blank page. You know, that's why one of my favorite cartoonists, Ralph Steadman, the way he starts drawing is he takes his ink pen and he flicks it at the page really hard. And these big ink splats land on the page. And then he looks at him and goes, hmm, okay. And then he sees something in there and gets to work. And that's like his way of, he just messes the page up right away. So you can just like go at it. I think this is the thing. This is another thing that people think happens with creative work. People think that artists get ideas in their big noggins, and then the idea is to just transmit the idea onto the page. It's not really what happens. It's a dance between the mind, the eye, the hand, and the page. And it's this loop. So it's often when you're drawing something or you're writing, you see something on the page, and that gives you as much of an idea as to what comes next.
Hmm.
Your hand tells your brain what to do next as much as your brain tells your hand. It's this very tricky thing. It's the thing that all musicians, all artists, all dancers, anyone who does anything creative, anyone who sculpts, anyone who like sews or knits or anything, it's a loop. And so it's not just about the idea and what happens. It's your interacting with the materials. And so that's why everyone is always kind of an amateur when it comes to this work, because, you know, you'll talk to novelists who have sold, you know, if you ask Stephen King if his last book's going to write his next one for him, he'll always say no. Like, you know, every book is different. Every story is different. Every time we come to the page, it's like a different thing. But I mean, in general, like the people who are really worried about, you know, not being ready to work, it's through the act of, one of the worst things I ever heard was this guy, I won't name who he was, but he said, you know, you really have to know who you are before you can make things. And I said, I think the opposite. I think it's in the making of things that you actually discover who you are. It's in the doing of things. It's your verbs that you actually discover, you know, what it is you actually have to offer. And I would actually say that that's the actual attraction of creative work, is to figure out what your potential is. What do you have inside of you? Like, what are you capable of? And when we teach writing to kids, we teach it so poorly, because we always think that, like, kids are always taught, like, you know, writing is about clearly conveying your ideas to people. And it's like, well, yeah, that's one function of writing. But the other function of writing is to figure out what you have to say to people. It's in the act of writing that you actually discover what it is that you think, because you might think you know what you think, but when you write it down on a page, well, wait a minute, that's not right. And then you have to like adjust. And that's like the magic of writing. And it's the same thing with drawing. Yeah, I see that tree. Oh, man. Wait a minute, that's not what it looks like. Oh, I've never noticed that the leaves turn this way. Oh, interesting. And that's the whole thing with drawing, is that when you actually draw the world, you have to look at it and look at it really closely. But in a general sense, I think that no one knows what they're doing. And in some ways, that's by design. Like, to make really good art, you kind of have to not know what you're doing. Like,
wow.
You kind of see this with bands and a lot. Like, I don't really know a lot about Taylor Swift, but if Taylor Swift just sits down to make, let's take Beyonce, because maybe I know a little bit more about Beyonce than Taylor Swift. But like, if Beyonce does an album that's just like the album she did before, she's just like not learning anything, right? She's not getting anywhere interesting. It's not helpful for her, because she doesn't discover anything new for herself. And then when she puts out the album, people are like, well, wait a minute, we've already heard this. So part of the job of a Beyonce or anyone else is to go somewhere they haven't gone before. Because they need to figure out where they're going. Then the question becomes, will the audience come with them? So it's this constant dance. You know, you're kind of strung, especially when you have an audience. It's really weird. I like to talk about when you become famous, because people always think if I get famous, it's going to be easier. And I always tell people, no, it's actually going to be worse for you, because when you have an audience, you're going to worry about, well, what if I do something they don't like? Will they come with me? You know,
yeah, whereas, there's expectations attached.
Exactly. When you're obscure, you can do what you want, because there's not, you know, so I always tell people, enjoy your obscurity while it lasts, you know, really have fun, play, experiment, do as much as you can. You think your problems are now when no one's paying attention. Your problems will really occur when people start showing up and caring. That's really going to, you know, that is something you'll, you know, it's a problem, but it's a good problem to have, but it's still a problem.
And that's in this book too. So like I said, I'm going to have my kids read these books, because they're teens and preteens. So what a great thing. I mean, everybody wants to be a YouTuber.
Yeah.
The percentage, yeah. Austin, is like so unbelievably high.
Yeah.
When people ask today, like kids, like, what do you want to do when you're an adult? I want to be a YouTuber.
Yeah. And it's weird, because you'll have someone like Mr. Beast, who, if you read like an interview with him, he's a profoundly unhappy person. Like he is like, I wouldn't speak for him that he's profoundly unhappy, but he doesn't know who he is, because part of what's he had, like, if you read an interview with him, he'll say, I don't know who I am anymore. I just do things based on like what I think people are going to like on YouTube. And that's just not I mean, it seems like kind of a nightmare to me to
Yeah.
be him, even though that's like who everyone wants to be. And so I think this is where like some good old fashioned like philosophy and this is what the humanities are for.
Yeah.
Like
Yeah.
this is where like a sense of purpose and or wherever this is what religion and philosophy have done for us for thousands of years. And so I think it's hard in today's world though. I mean, like, yeah, the YouTube thing is really, I know some YouTubers and they're really nice people, but they always hit this wall where they realize that what they're doing is a they're on a kind of human treadmill that never ends.
That's right. You got to feed the machine.
Yeah, you feed the machine and you're constantly adjusting for the algorithm. And I have to say, the older I get, the more I'm really inspired by people who almost have nothing to do with formulas or algorithms at all. Like some of the plumbers I know.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's few and far between these days.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I've been really, really fascinated by how much the trades are coming back. As for young, because young people are really starting to see, well, wait a minute, like if you can actually do things that people need done, there's like a real need for this work. And I think that's really interesting. So I don't know. I'm not a doom and gloom person when it comes to young people. On the whole, I usually find that young people are much more interesting and interested than most people give them credit for, especially if they're put in the right situation and the right environments.
Sure. Yeah. So this, I mean, I think though for young people, the ideas in here, and I just want to really reiterate, it's so practical. There's a sentence, go to whatever lengths necessary to make sure you always have paper on you. There actually was a lot of clarification for me, Austin, about this. No one knows what they're doing. That makes a lot of sense. It's happening in real time.
Right.
I actually didn't realize that, I guess. And
Yeah.
so that makes a lot more sense. It's this interplay. There's value in the uncertainty. You talk even about writing. A lot of kids love to write. A lot of adults say, I want to be an author. You say, write what you know is terrible advice. Write what you like. Write the book you would want to read. You
Yeah.
talked about Stephen Pressfield in here, which maybe I even found him through you. And then I've now read his books, which I really love. But he's saying, like, people are really busy. So he said, it's not that people are mean or cruel. They're just busy. You really have to have a good foundation here. The obscurity is a good thing. I mean, it's just one practical thing. An interesting thing after the next, the Jerry Seinfeld wall chain, that type of thing. And then you do talk about, and I guess maybe this is a good transition from the YouTube piece and the social media piece, which is very focused down. It's like, are you the sourdough person? Are you the essential oils person? You know, are
Right.
you this? It's you're very much in a box. And you, one of the key things in this book is do it all, do the things. Don't just do one thing.
Yeah, if you're someone who, I'm a person who I just always liked a lot of different things. I like to do a lot of different things. I love to draw. I love to play on my computer. I love to make music. I love to write. I love to read. And I felt a real pressure when I was younger to choose. Like, well, you just have to choose one. And every time I chose, I got so sad. Every time, like, I tried to choose and I said, oh, I'm just gonna like focus on this thing, I really felt that kind of like a phantom limb pain, like something had kind of been like cut off of me. And my life only really got interested when I realized that I just had to kind of like keep all these things in play. There's a wonderful guy here in town, Stephen Tomlinson, who's a friend of mine. And he just became a priest, actually. So now I can say I know a priest. But so now I might even be able to say my priest, but he's not, but he's my friend. And one of the things he says is he went to his mentor and he said, look, I love God. I love playwriting and I love economics. Which one should I choose? And the guy looked at him and he said, that's the dumbest question anyone ever asked me. And he said, if you truly love these things, if they're all passions, you need to figure out a way to spend a little bit of time with them every week and keep them in your life. And if you don't get a career out of that, what you'll end up with is at least a life. It'll be your life. And the great joy and blessing of my life is that the more I'm myself, the more I am all the things that I like to do, and the more I like kind of follow my own passions and stuff, the more people seem to show up. It's a very strange thing. I think part of it is that if we use another metaphor, I'm not a baseball guy, but I had a friend explain to me one time if you're just a hitter in baseball, like if you can only hit the ball, you got to be the best hitter. Like you got to be able to hit it out of the park every time. Like you got to be a slugger. But if you can hit and you can run, it's like,
Good.
then all of a sudden, okay, we could do different things with you. You can bunt and hit the base. You can, whatever. And then he's like, if you can hit, run, and field, then we're adding things. So there's I think it's called like the five elements of, but again, this is why I don't use the metaphor that much because I'm not that much of a baseball guy. The idea is if you only do one thing, you have to be really, 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 really good at, you have to be the best at that thing. But if you could do two things all of a sudden, and you could do them competently, not great, like you just have to be competent at two things, then all of a sudden you create this collage, this third thing, that 1 + 1 = 3 kind of thing. Just like in art, where you take one thing, you put another thing next to it, and suddenly there's a new thing. Then you can kind of like create a life that's interesting, and you can kind of position yourself in an interesting way. It's a marketing device in a sense, but really what it is taking the things that really make you you, and then figuring out how you can place yourself in the world where that's a value to other people. And I think that's all what we're trying to do, like with our kids and with ourselves and everything, is we're trying to figure out, okay, well, what makes me come alive when I do it, and how can that help people be alive in their lives? Whether it's actually helping them stay alive or doing something for them, or everything's kind of a service industry. Like when I write a newsletter, I'm always thinking like, okay, I'm gathering these things that I thought were worthy to show people, but I'm also serving it to them, like a meal or something, or a 10-course meal or something. I don't even know where I started there, but yeah, the idea that if you cut the things that you truly love out of your life just because you're like trying to drill down and be serious, you're just going to be a really sad person. So like if you're going to med school but you really love playing the clarinet, like you got to keep playing the clarinet. You can't stop playing the clarinet. Like eventually you'll wind up like an old sad 45-year-old, and you'll quit your med job and you'll pick up the clarinet and play it on the street. So you might as well just keep playing it, Like you got to keep these things that you love that keep you alive in your life. You just have to,
That's good. The sentence, don't throw any of yourself away. Ooh, that's good, Austin. And you talk about have a bunch of projects going on at once, bounce between them. There's a lot in here about just taking the time to do nothing, which is something that we talk about is the value of being bored. You have this paragraph, I get some of my best ideas when I'm bored, which is why I never take my shirt to the cleaners. I love ironing my shirts. It's so boring. I almost always get good ideas. If you're out of ideas, wash the dishes, take a really long walk. Stare at a spot on the wall for as long as you can. So just a lot, and even you say it's a lot of energy to be creative. And I think so much of it gets sucked out in adult life. Like kids are creative, I think, because they have more to draw from. They have more time and more energy. So you talk about keeping your life kind of a little boring, and it's going to help you be more creative.
Yeah, I mean, it's more just like, yeah, it's not being stimulated, it's not having that kind of 24/7 beep 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 in your head all the time. But yeah, it's just like, I mean, I just all those things that you listed. I mean, when we get bored, it's like you create a space. Boredom and silence and stillness creates a space in which something can happen, and I think it creates a space within us in which things then kind of enter. And all the great religions tell us that, when we silence ourselves, when we clear ourselves, that then things come in, right? So it's but for me, the boredom thing, people will do anything to avoid being bored. And for me, it's like the easiest way, like I always say, never get Wi-Fi on a plane. Just don't do it, because you don't want anything to do on a plane. You want to be strapped in a chair in the sky with nothing to do. That's when you will, that's when I get to work. Like, I've done some of my best work, strapped to a chair in the sky. Like, you're not going anywhere.
Maybe that's the power of the shower too.
Oh, yeah.
It's the only time. I mean, people aren't checking their text messages. They'll
Bring them out. Yeah, and just the complete relaxation. You know, you're kind of like, I mean, it opens up your sinuses and it opens up your mind. You know, it's like, but yeah, I think that's true too. The bathroom is kind of an interesting zone in the house because it's the one place where you can't really be bothered unless you bring something in with you that bothers you, like your phone, you know? So I don't actually bring my phone into the bathroom anymore. I don't do that anymore. I'm like, no, going to the bathroom.
Awesome. These books are so fantastic. I mean, I got so much. I learned so much. I got so much out of them as a person who wants to be more creative but doesn't feel super creative, as you can tell by my backdrop in comparison to yours. Feel like an artist. It was like the coolest gift to get at this conference. And then, like I said, I've read the other ones, Show Your Work and Keep Going, which are both so encouraging. Show Your Work, 10 Ways to Share Your Creativity and Get Discovered, but Keep Going, 10 Ways to Stay Creative in Good Times and Bad. Steal Like an Artist is 10 Things Nobody Told You About Being Creative. People can find them at austincleon.com or anywhere you buy your books, as well as this newsletter with almost 200,000 subscribers and all the other things that we talked about, which is like, what are the cool books that you've read over the past 15 plus years and cool gear. There's a lot that people can find at your website, austincleon.com. We always end with the same question. And that question is, what's a favorite memory from your childhood that was outside?
Oh, outside. I hated being outside when I was a kid. I absolutely despised being outside. I did, I think probably being in the pool with my mom. Like our neighbor had a pool, and I loved being in the pool with my mom and listening to the radio. And that's what I do with my kids now, is we sit in the pool and we listen to the radio. So, yeah.
That's what did you despise?
Favorite. Just hate. I grew up in the, like, I grew up in, like, you know, I didn't grow up in like the woods rural. I grew up in like a cornfield rural, which is just like flat and like not a lot to do. I was greatly envious of two groups of friends that I had. One of my great, like fourth grade, one of my friends lived on a farm that looked amazing. Big farmhouse, lots of tractors. They used to make hay bales. They used to make mazes out of hay bales. Baling hay is the most miserable thing you can do, but like that was really fun. And then the other kids I really admired or was jealous of, interestingly, was the kids who lived in the place called The Village, which was this housing development that was actually for factory workers at the RCA plant. That was mostly where people lived. So it was like actually kind of lower income housing. And these kids, a lot of them had like single parents that worked all the time, and they got to like ride around on their bikes together and like get into trouble and had this kind of like more wild free-rangey thing. I really despised growing up on like a little acre plot where you just like have your house and it's like you can't ride your bike on the road, you get run over. You know, that was like a really hard thing for me to grow up. So I just discovered the outdoors when I was older. Like it really took me being older to really like enjoy being outside and like to really enjoy like nature and stuff. So I'm one of those people that if your readers are panicking about not having outdoorsy kids, just because you're not an outdoorsy kid when you're younger, it could still happen for you later on. I am proof of it.
I love that. So encouraging. Austin, what an honor. I'm so glad.
Thank you. These were really great questions.
My husband asked because I was so nervous.
Again, what is a husband for?
Thank you, Austin. The books are great. The trilogy will be great to add to any home. Also, just beyond that, they're going to look awesome on your shelf. So if you care about that, they match and they're a really cool size and shape and they even feel cool. They're fantastic books. Austin, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. This was really fun.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play, and we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. you get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.